Thanks, Reyes, for not reading my whole CV, because this will save me some time for questions. We have been, by we is a bunch of us, including Agra people, including other partners, we have been given periodic reports, sort of every 2 years, on the African Green Revolution. And I like to combine my assignment, which is to look at the more soils and water type, while Debbie Delmer looks at the germplasm with that. I think right now we can define the Green Revolution as going from 1 to 3 tons per hectare of maize, or its equivalent in other crops, even though we're going to have more variable rainfall in the next 10 years or so. We think this is perfectly possible. And let's get some of our metrics straightened out. Cereal yields, I'm using maize again. Cereal yields in sub-Saharan Africa average about 1 ton. And that's sort of the current production that you see in most places. In Latin America, it's 3. In South Asia, it's 3. In China, it's 5. In North America and Europe, it's 10. And you have the bushels per acre equivalent there. For those who think in bushels per acre, you have it there. Yesterday, we were hearing talks saying that 16 tons may be the maximum. And, well, I hope it's more than that, but I'm quite happy with that. But our job in Africa is simply to go from 1 to 3. And in a way, it's somewhat simpler because you're on the sharp part of the response curve. It's not simple politically, let me tell you. The overarching problems of soils where smallholder farmers work in sub-Saharan Africa are not, the entry point is not improved varieties. It's unhealthy, nutrient-depleted soils, most of them classified as alfasols, and they were pretty good soils, but they've had their nutrients taken out. And water that can flood you, like the upper right-hand side picture of water flowing over a flat piece of land in Niger in the Sahel, and then the increasing droughts. And now we have clear evidence of more weather variability, more seasonable variability. Now, on July 5th, 2004, then Secretary General Kofi Annan did make a call for a 21st century African Green Revolution. And he did it at a seminar on innovative approaches to meeting the Hunger Millennium Development Goal in Africa, attended by most African presidents, ministers, and so on. So this was a call to action. This was serious. And when Kofi Annan makes statements like this, things do happen. The previous one was, let's get serious about AIDS in Africa. And things have happened on AIDS in Africa. Kofi had the vision of, this is not the old Green Revolution of the Asian when I was a graduate student in the Philippines and Norman Borlaug was leading it. It involves agriculture, but it involves primarily the components of soil, water, and improved seeds. We never can forget improved seeds. And they're right there with the soil and water. But it also involves human nutrition and maternal and child nutrition. It involves making markets work for the poor, and markets don't work for the poor automatically, they work for the rich. And this is something that Agra has done a magnificent job. It all has to be done in tune with the environment. We learned a few things since the 60s, such as agroforestry, soil conservation, and so on. It has to be backed up by policies, and it has to be backed up by politics. And so those five elements have to be there, and we cannot blame ourselves if we just look at one. The main consequences of Kofi Annan's call to action in July 2004, I tried to summarize here. The African governments, meeting in Maputo, I don't recall the year, but it was shortly thereafter, decided to commit themselves to put 10% of their national budgets into agriculture. And then they created, through NEPAD, something called CADEP, which is a Common Agricultural Development Program. Some countries have done that. And those are the countries that are in Bashir's list of the countries that are making a lot of progress. Some countries have not done that, and they're not on that list. So there's perhaps the most important thing that we can see now is that there is seriousness in many African governments, many large African governments, to get hunger over with and to get out of the absolute poverty trap, disease trap, and so on. They are serious. Some of them are not. I don't waste my time trying to work with Zimbabwe at this point, or Somalia, or the DR Congo, or Guinea-Bissau, or countries that are not serious. They've got other bigger problems to handle. Then the second thing was the creation of AGRA, the Alliance for a Green Revolution. And this is a conception of the Ford and Gates, the Rockefeller and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations, to have an organization really designed to push this. And they funded it pretty lavishly. And it is chaired, as the chairman of the board is Kofi Annan, and has programs, as Bashir said, one in seeds, headed by Joe DeVries. Bashir heads the soil health programs and then have programs in policy, in water, in markets, and other ones. It's an organization based in Nairobi that is really designed to push the African Green Revolution. When Borlaug was doing his thing in the 1960s in India and Pakistan, he was doing it on his own and with his buddies. Now this is a bit more organized, and in this case, it's Africa-led. Third thing happened is the UN Millennium Project, which I'm my current affiliation, the Earth Institute of Columbia University, is a part of that, with the development of the Millennium Villages as a so what response to the recommendations we put out in the UN Millennium Projects on ways to accomplish the Millennium Development Goals. And it's not only the Millennium Villages, but we have two MDG centers for policy advice, one headquartered in Nairobi for Eastern Southern Africa, and one headquartered in Bamako for Western Southern Africa. And then earlier this year still, in April of this year, we saw some of our dreams come true. We've been pushing for a global a global fund for food and agriculture, the same as a very successful global fund to fight malaria, TB, and AIDS. Didn't quite succeed. It's not even called that. We're not allowed to call it that. It has an unpronounceable acronym, as you see over there. We thought we would need about something in the order of $20 billion a year. And well, we got $0.8 billion in the kitty promised, of which maybe $200 million are actually in the pots. So it's there. Not very proud of the achievement, but at least I think we should be proud of the fact that the donor countries got together and are doing something about it, albeit much lower than what they promised. So I mention now, again, that the goal of the African Green Revolution can be quantified. That's one thing for planners to do, quantify. Go from 1 to 3 tons per hectare. These are both pictures in Malawi taken in February of this year of what I thought would be a 1 ton per hectare yield crop and what I thought it would be a 3 ton per hectare yield crop. Those are pretty achievable. So 3 ton per hectare yield crop is 48 bushel to the acre. So those of you thinking in American terms, that's no big deal when we're talking about 200-300 bushel to the acre here. But look, remember the open soil cover in the 1 ton per hectare and the pretty closed soil canopy cover in the 3 tons per hectare. A goal also should be time-bound. And my time-bound proposal is the next 10 years. And that's fast, but I think it can be done. In the Millennium Villages, we decided to see what would it take for a typical millennium, a typical village of 5,000 people located in hunger hotspots of Africa, different hunger hotspots to Africa, to accomplish all the Millennium Development Goals by the due date of 2015. And we organized first this as a private venture, then my wife and I, and then second, everything exploded. And before we knew it, we had a budget from all from the private sector, except for the governor of Japan, of almost $150 million to do so. Out of that, there are 80 such villages in 14 clusters, and the names you see there in squares are the clusters. Each one really showing a major agricultural zone and farming systems. I see some villages missing the newer ones, like Toya in near Timbuktu in Mali, and Gumulira in northern Malawi. But anyway, right now there are 80 villages with initially about 5,000 people each, all in hunger hotspots. Now it's probably people are moving back from the towns to the villages, so we're probably dealing with a total of about 800,000 people, or about 120,000 households. This has been going on, the older villages for about 5 years, the younger villages for about a year, so it varies, and it deals with all the issues: agriculture, health, education, water, sanitation, environment, gender issues. Help me out, Cheryl, am I missing something? No, okay. On the agriculture side, I'm very happy to tell you that our agricultural coordinator, Jenny Rose and Zigu Heba. Jenny Rose, would you stand up, whatever you are? There she is back there. She's the senior author of an article just published in Advances in Agronomy with the results from the first 3 years. It's got umpteen papers, umpteen authors, and I think it's published now. Maybe this is the the so-called electronic copy. But anyway, there's the data. But one thing that happened in the village is a funny combination, which we thought it was very necessary, of community leadership and be science-based. Usually some of these things clash against each other. And the community leadership is absolutely necessary. And the science base enables us to say, hey, oh, this is very nice, but this is not really confirmed in your area. And let's not look after the ideology of X or Y practice, but look at what we know based on the data known. There's been no experiments done in the Millennium Village except for the process experiments. Below is a simple agroforestry experiment in Malawi, showing the nitrogen fixation capacity of Neisseria sapiens. So yeah, this has been going for about 20 years. Yeah, it works. So yeah, we recommended that. But the community didn't accept it. They wanted fertilizing. They wanted larger gains, so we went along with the community. And indeed, what they wanted was inputs and a clinic. And I'll talk about the agricultural side here. Inputs were fertilizers and hybrid maize seed for those maize-growing countries. The best recommendations of locally produced hybrid maize seed from local seed companies. And when that truck arrived in Sauri Village in February 2005, Cheryl, Bashir, you were there, it was really a party. And everybody was carrying a bag of seed, like that lady on the left-hand side. And what we saw as the crop was growing was something that looked like it's gonna reach 5 tons per hectare. And outside of the village, on the same soil, same climate, with normal practice, they did average 1.2. So from the yellow chlorotic maize to a bumper crop. This changed, and this is a bumper crop. This changed the way people looked at themselves. All of a sudden, they had enough to eat and more than that. And on the health side, they had malaria bed nets and therapy for malaria and other critical diseases, which is just as important, and the interaction between the two is absolutely necessary. It's been happening now in all the maize-growing villages and other villages, and I have here Siglindi Snap somewhere in the audience. Very, very happy when she and I were in Gumulira in Malawi in February, seeing a crop that also reached about 5 tons per hectare. Sig, where are you? There she is. I thought you were happy. Okay, basically the data shows, and this is the data of sample, a small sample of that would average, that would represent 1,000 farms and 16 harvested in 7 millennium villages all over Africa. The maize yields with interventions average 4.1 tons per hectare, way over the 3 ton per hectare goal that we had set, and it has a range. The maize yields without intervention average 1.7, better than the average, but also with a range. So the maize yields increased by 2.4 tons per hectare. And then we look at the cost of the inputs to produce an extra ton of maize at the actual prices. And they average $82 per hectare. But then, because of the spike in food and fertilizer prices in 2008, we look at the at all the costs converted to the cost and prices of 2008, and they average $135 to produce an extra ton of maize. I want you to remember that number, 135. The value to cost ratios are either actual prices or at the peak prices were about the same. Economists tell me that anything above 2 is good. There was a range, and you see obviously the lowest range here was no good, but and mostly it was good. I ask you to remember this number, 135. That's what it takes to produce an extra ton of maize in Africa with the inputs. It doesn't involve labor costs or anything else. And you may compare it with 1 ton of maize delivered in inland in Africa as food aid, and it's $812 per ton. So you can give people a fish to eat for a day, and it'll cost you 6 times what would empower the fish. And I'm so glad to see that the World Food Program, supported by the Gates Foundation and the Buffett Foundation and other ones, have made a purchase for progress program, in which now they are sourcing, that is buying food from these farmers that are producing a lot of food and using that as food aid instead of importing this very expensive, obsolete concept of food aid from the rich countries. You need those for the disaster areas. You need the, but not for the farming areas. Other initial impacts of the Millennium Villages, this is, we had a baseline study that Cheryl masterminded, and year three. I won't go through all of them, but the percent of households with maize yields of more than 3 tons per hectare or equivalent in cassava or other crops went from less than 10 to 78%. This is very important to tell you that there's still a significant proportion of the village that didn't get enough yields. And those are the very poorest of the poor, usually widows with very little land. The percentages of households not having enough food for at least 1 month a year went from 69 to 35%. In other words, hunger is still there. This ain't perfect. But the percent of stunted children, less than 2 years old, which is an example of chronic malnutrition, went from 50% to 36%. Those kids during year three were not born during the baseline period. And I'm very glad to see chubby babies around village meetings that below I didn't see. The other ones, treated under malaria bed nets, great progress. Households with access to improved water source, great progress too. To improve sanitation, that means a concrete pad over a latrine, tremendous improvement. Households with mobile phones, about a third of them have them. The IT revolution has reached them in ways they can afford. Nothing to do with us, but this happened. And with women with access to more modern contraceptives, has increased. And percent birth attended by skilled health workers, midwives, has also increased. Now, that's at the village scale. And they're scattered all over the place. And in each country, they have caused some sort of a publicity commotion because the president and the major donors and all that have seen. But now I'd like to talk about Malawi, which is the first African Green Revolution country in the genuine sense of the word. You've heard about Malawi in this convention yesterday. But in 2005, Malawi was going through a drought year, and newly elected President Bingu wa Mutharika asked Jeffrey Sachs and myself to come down and ask for advice. He says, I didn't get elected to be a country with a beggar bowl. What do you suggest? I said, why, sir? The UN Millennium Project Hunger Task Force suggests that you subsidize hybrid seeds and fertilizers for maize. And he said, okay, I'll do it, and asked his Minister of Finance to do it. The Minister of Finance came in the next day saying the donor said absolutely not. The donors were USAID, DFID, World Bank. Says, don't you know we don't subsidize African farmers? And on a very ideological thing, of course, we spend about $1 billion a day subsidizing our American, European, and Japanese farmers. So this is where political will come in. Bingu decided to do it by himself with his own budget. Malawi is not an extraordinary country in any sense. It's a very poor country. It's landlocked. It has terrible roads. It has corruption. It's high with AIDS, everything you can think of. But Bingu produced a voucher that said that you could get a bag of starting fertilizer, and a bag of top dressing fertilizer, and 3 kilos of hybrid seed or 5 kilos of open pollinated recommended maize varieties at a 75% discount. And anybody who had a farm could do this. This is a smart subsidy, even though subsidy is a dirty word. It's a smart subsidy because large farmers couldn't care less about getting a couple of bags at a discount. And it worked. And what you see over there is what many of us saw during the planting time, nutrients on the move in the bag of bicycles, in the head of people, and so on. And the results were amazing. The harvest year, harvest is in April in Malawi. The harvest year of 2005 was the drought year. That's before anything happened. They produced only 1.3 million tons. Their food requirements, they had a 43% deficit supplied by the World Food Program. National average yields were just under a ton. The first year of the subsidy program, they increased dramatically, went from a food deficit to a food surplus, and their yields doubled. But it was considered a good year, not a drought year. The second year, the donors got into the act, many of them claiming that it was their own idea, and the yields went up much more, 3.3 tons, 57% surplus. Malawi became a food exporting country, selling its maize to Zimbabwe and the World Food Program for other places, and even became a donor, a food aid donor to neighboring Lesotho and Swazilands that were having a food crisis. The average national yields almost got to 3 tons per hectare. And I'm talking not about experimental results or Millennium Village, I'm talking about average in a maize-growing country, 2.7, but it was a good year. 2.8 went down a bit, was also a good year, 2008. 2009, it went up again, it was a very good year, 2.2 tons per hectare. So for the last 4 years, it's been very good, but those last 4 years had good rainfall. 2010, this year, the harvest of April was declared a drought year. And we say, aha, now this is the time to test the whole thing. The program continued. The production went down from the good year, but still they ended up with a 33% surplus and a 1.9 ton per hectare average yield, which is really the average of the 5 years. They made almost 2 tons per hectare. The cost of the national subsidy was $70 million a year in 2007. The benefits about 10 times more. So what happened? Aha. We, in the villages, we were able to look at the effect of the good rains only in one of those good rain years. That is, they didn't apply fertilizer or good seed. The increases in yields were 1.4 tons, and the ones with fertilizer and seed, 68%. So most of this is was a nitrogen drought, not a drought. This is a way, I was amazed. I drove through half of Malawi in February of this year, and this is what I was seeing. And I was seeing this 3 tons per hectare. Occasionally, I saw this, crop failure. And those are areas that got a drought spell during the rainy season. And the question is now, let's focus on those areas. But most of it looked very, very good. So where are we now? Where are we now in the Green Revolution? We're not, after 5 years, we're not yet at the tipping point, in my opinion. Our estimate is that 2 million smallholder households are out of hunger and are now producing about 3 tons per hectare of maize, or the equivalent. Equivalent in cocoa yields in Ghana, or camel milk yields in eastern Kenya. They also have tripled their production in your area, Bashir. So we estimate about 2 million smallholder. That's a very rough estimate. We also estimate that there are 100 million hungry smallholder households in sub-Saharan Africa. Bashir is correcting me right before the talk, says there's 69 million only. I said, okay, well, maybe now we are, the percentage is a little bit higher, but we're not at the tipping point. So African Green Revolution 2.0, which is what I'm calling for now, because the job of getting it going, a lot of it done by AGRA, a lot of it done by other organizations, I'm not trying to claim any personal or institutional credit here, it's off. So African Green Revolution 2.0 to me involves improving the efficiency and scaling up from 2 million to 69 million households. I'm corrected. Next time I look at that slide on my computer, I will correct it. Improving the efficiency can be done with AFSIS, this digital soil map of the world that is in progress in Africa with pixels at 90 by 90 meters. So 0.8 hectares, something relevant to farmers. And the possibilities of now having smartphones, Androids, to serve for data collection. And even now there's a handheld spectrometer in the market here in the States. I want to talk to Bill Ron. I don't know if he's on the audience, but I want to catch him and learn more about this. Now we're interacting with Google, and what we're trying to do is basically, eventually there'll be a spectrophotometer in our smartphones, and you can take a picture of a soil or a maize leaf, and at the right maize leaf at the right time, blah, 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 and you get a bunch of squiggles, and this could be transmitted to somebody who can turn those squiggles into additional needs for phosphorus or high probabilities of crop failure because of drought spell, and so on and so on and so on, speaking in probabilities, which is the digital way. The second one is a transition to high-value crops and enterprises. And this woman from Sauri, Kenya, she's produced so much maize that she's bought a couple of cows for a dairy business. She constructed a shed there for a chicken business, and she gave her son somehow a posho mill, a mill that he in the village he can grind for a fee, the grain of other people. You notice that she is talking on a cell phone. And so a lot of this is not to flood Africa with maize, but she can actually grow her maize only on a smaller size of her 1 hectare plot, and the rest she can devote to, in this case, forage for those things, or growing vegetables and so on. The third one, which is very important, is we've got to add organic inputs to what it is a fertilizer-based revolution. I don't know of any system in the world that relies only on organic fertilizers, and my colleagues in the fertilizer business agree with me. So they're nitrogen-fixing trees that are well-proven. They're cover crops that are well-proven to add and recycle nutrients. And we have to worry about N2O emissions and nitrate leaching. That will happen in Africa now as Africa gets loaded by nitrogen for the first time in its history. So this is a major, major issue, both the fact that we need to have the organics there to get carbon, there are carbon sequestration consequences, but also the fact that we in a very broad sense are loading up Africa with nitrogen for the first time in history, and we don't want to make the mistakes made here and being made now at a very large scale in China. Mobile banks, Bashir talk about credit, and this may be the cat's meow, but Opportunity International, an NGO, brings a mobile bank to the village in Malawi with a generator, computer, and starts it up and give people a smart card, smarter than the one we have to get into our hotel rooms here, because it has your thumbprint and your picture too, and you can begin to get into the marketing system. And many people are saying, I'm putting my money now in the bank instead of under the mattress. And when I get a little bit angry with the world, I go to the pub and drink it away. Now, water. Water is going to be much more difficult than before. We know that. But one thing I wanted to leave here is, what is the percent of irrigation? In Africa, it's very little. It's 3%. So is in Latin America. The big areas that are irrigated in terms of croplands are South Asia and China, 38 and 50%. But guess what? Here, in North America and Europe, our percent of irrigated land is puny. It's very small. I never realized that until I saw the figures. So, yeah, it would be good to get more irrigation, but so it would be here in this country. So the fact that North America and Europe are mostly 91% rain-fed, I should tell you something about improving rain-fed agriculture. How to do it? Yeah, small scale, drip irrigation for high value crops, absolutely. Some village scale, community scale conservations. This is in Ethiopia, in our village in northern Ethiopia, where these people move mountains literally by stone, make gabions to counteract the gullies, make these storage areas that are gonna allow the extra water to be stored in the subsoil, and then they dig it out as wells. The agrivets, or more commonly known as agri-dealers, something that Agra initiated, linking people in mom-and-pop shops like this to sell hybrid seed, fertilizer, fertile pumps, or so, to know about it and to be and make money too. This is a very important part of Agra's program. And then we have an enemy that has recently arrived in Africa. It's a larger grain borer and eats stored maize in a jiffy. It powders it. The name, the local name in many countries of this larger grain borer is Osama. And that gives you an idea of what people feel about it. Well, we should do something about storage. We should do something about Osama. Not because of the name, but the fact that everybody says, as conventional wisdom, that we lose 30-40% of our harvest in storage. And that's a low-hanging fruit. So I'm making a call in this African Grain Revolution 2.0 to get serious about harvest losses, both pre-harvest and post-harvest losses. Precision agriculture, African style, Bashir has talked about that. And there are many, many other systems. And then finally, I want to deal, and this will be my last comment, on work that Johan Rockström has done from Sweden, in which he looks as grain yields, cereal yields increase from 1 to 10 tons per hectare, how much of that goes into soil evaporation. You see it decreases drastically with increasing yields. How much of that goes through the plant as transpiration? It increases drastically with increasing yields. And particularly at the shift from 1 to 3. Now from 1 to 3, we look at the last column, percent transpiration. You only get 15% of your soil moisture, whatever the source, transpired by the plant. And when you get to 3 tons per hectare without a drop of irrigation, you triple that. And of course, it keeps going higher the higher you get. So, And adaptation to a drier climate, the numbers are not exactly the same as the previous table, but the idea is the same, that if you can shift from 13% of your soil moisture into transpiration growing crops into something like 63 or 70%, we can do a lot to adapt to drier climate without an extra drop of water. And we should do all sorts of other things. But this is one simple principle of agronomy that we haven't studied very much because we never dealt at yield levels of 1 to 3 tons per hectare in the developed world. It matters a lot. Now, the second point is scale-ups, and they're major ones. We're not going to multiply the number of millennium villages. That's enough. But in Nigeria, the governor of Nigeria has put 115 local governments, which is sort of counties or sub-counties, local government agencies with 20 million people in a program that's costing them about $750 million a year of the government's own money. This is Nigerian money. They're basing the recommendations on the two villages, Pampaira and Ikaram, that we have, Millennium Villages. They concentrate on health, education, and agriculture. They're quite serious about it, in spite of all the bad things you hear about Nigeria. If it can happen in Nigeria, and of course going from 2 million people affected by to 20 million people, then that may be the tipping point. I think they need all the support we can, and they're serious. They're very, very serious. And they've gone through, the person who leads this, who's a special advisor to the president, her name is Amina Ibrahim, tough lady, tough Fulani lady. She's been a special advisor to 3 presidents now. So she's likely to stay running it from the very top. Mali, they have an initiative 166, which is a whole shebang, the full Millennium Village projects with health, education, extension, water, sanitation, World Bank financing. It's about to start. Tanzania is spending $300 million in agricultural input subsidies. Malawi, the import support continuation. And there could be others, possibly supported by the Global Trust Funds. So we've had meetings like this, trying to get the key decision makers with key people, ministers, and so on. And even though this was in 2008, we happen to have the head of USAID now, Russia, and the head of NIFA, the National Institute for Food and Agriculture, Roger Beachy, there. They were occupying different hats, but luckily they are leaders now. And a global fund came up. So in conclusion, we're not yet at the tipping point. I'll probably change that to 3% now, after what Bashir told me, 2-3% of the job done. But the political moment is very good. While the political moment is awful in this country now, for other reasons, the political moment is actually very, very good in many countries. And is the countries, and I would say about maybe half, maybe wrong, the 48 sub-Saharan African countries, an easy number to remember, maybe half of them, maybe a third of them, have governments that are really serious about agriculture. So work with the winners. Also, more donor countries and institutions like the Gates Foundation are very serious about agriculture. Work with the ones who are serious. And finally, I'm very hot on Agra. We work very closely together. I spend quite a bit of my time with Bashir roaming around Africa because now it's one institution fully dedicated to the African Green Revolution and deserves its support. So African Green Revolution 2.0, let's get it done. Thank you.